But first, I kind of wanted to get a sense of how it went. I mean, did those questions sort of too easy, too hard, good? Any comments? Okay. Well, if you have them, feel free to email me while I'm preparing the next set of tutorial questions. First of all, Tibra said that there was some confusion related to a typo. Had you been discussing the relative ratios?
Yeah, but you probably want to repeat the type of solution.
Okay, yeah. So the typo is in the solution and not the problem. But the point of the second problem was just to show that you can argue based on the scaling that rho matter typically scales like a to the minus 3 and rho radiation scales like a to the minus 4. So if I take their ratio, rho matter to rho radiation, this goes like a, which of course grows with time. So as the universe expands, I'm always eventually the amount of matter is going to win out over the amount of radiation. And so the fact that in our universe we observe rho radiation over rho matter something like 10 to the minus 4. The fact that they're actually kind of close to one another tells us that the point at which they were both equally important was only a few powers of 10 away. So you know, if the temperature at the CMB is now 10 to the minus 4 EV, it was when the universe was around EV, okay, which is not very early considering things that we've been looking at. Tibra also mentioned that there was a question regarding equilibrium and whether you can use distributions for particles after they've gone out of equilibrium. So if I have a species that is at one point in equilibrium, then while it's in equilibrium, I can write the distribution function just in terms of the equilibrium one. So this is going to be e to the e minus mu over t minus plus 1.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So this is when it's in equilibrium. When it decouples from the photon bath, as we saw yesterday, that typically happens in two stages. First, you lose chemical equilibrium, and what that means is that annihilations of the particle into photons, say, or into other particles, this turns off first, typically. And so what happens then is that the number of particles I can't change anymore. Okay. And so what that means is that the total number is not going to be equal to the equilibrium number density, but I'm still going to have elastic scatterings like this. And these are typically going to continue. Okay. I mean, you can also count. So when this is true, the typical momentum of your other state is still the same as the typical momentum of the photon because these kinds of interactions share momenta. So in this case, what we find is that Fi is proportional, exactly proportional to the equilibrium number density. But because the number, which is the integral of this density, is different, that means that there's some constant here. Constant with respect to energy. Okay. So that the shape of the distribution is the same, but when I integrate it, I get a different number. Then when this turns off, if we assume that it happens very quickly, then this distribution essentially stays the same in terms of the momentum because it's not interacting anymore. And so this is just frozen in with time. The only thing that changes is that, remember that as the universe is expanding, things get redshifted. So the momenta decrease with the scale factor, but the functional form of it stays the same. Okay. So even out of equilibrium, if something was in thermal contact, its spectrum looks like a thermal spectrum just because that's the imprint of the fact that it was coupled with a thermal bath. What I will say is that in deriving this Boltzmann equation yesterday, we had some equation for how the Fs changed. Where was it? It was sort of an intermediate step that we derived. It was e df dt minus h p squared df dE is equal to 0. So what we did was we integrated this by d3p, and that gives you this. But if I really want to find the full f out of equilibrium, what I can just do is take this differential equation and solve it. And so this was in the case of no interactions, but there's going to be some interaction piece here. And the interaction piece, you know, the Feynman diagrams we compute are going to be momentum dependent. So it's a reasonable approximation to just assume a thermal-like spectrum, but in principle you can, and if you're dealing with sort of weird interactions, you should actually just solve the full equation. But what this does is it justifies us continuing to use sort of the same kinds of distributions, even once you're out of equilibrium, as long as you're careful about the particle number. Yes. Yeah, so this is like T-channel scattering off of some, you know, electron or something in the thermal bath. So, of course, the precise diagrams depend on what is there, but you're generically always going to have both an annihilation and an elastic scattering. Okay, good. So last time we discussed this phenomenon of freeze-out, and we did it using dimensional analysis. So we derived the form of the rates associated with each of these processes. So we can compare them to Hubble. Just to remind ourselves what the goal is that we're trying to show of the full analysis, we found using dimensional analysis that when a particle is relativistic, its scattering rate scales like the temperature. But when it becomes non-relativistic, there's this Boltzmann suppression of its annihilation rate, just because it has a hard time finding a partner to annihilate with. So what I've drawn here is the yield, which is the number density divided by a cubed, essentially, or times a cubed. What you see is that this is constant up until it becomes non-relativistic. Once it becomes non-relativistic, there's an exponential damping of the number density. And this dashed line is the equilibrium number density. So if I just stayed in thermal equilibrium, it would always just exponentially be damped away, and I would essentially be left with nothing. However, what we found is that the scattering rate also goes like this exponential. And so at a certain time, I'm no longer going to annihilate efficiently. And so my annihilation is going to stop, and I'm just going to be left with some amount of stuff. Okay? And that amount of stuff is just going to evolve according to this Boltzmann equation that we derived yesterday. It's just going to be a flat line. So this is the sort of actual y. And we see that the stronger the annihilation, the larger this rate, the longer I'm going to stay in equilibrium. So what I can do is determine the amount of this final state by what my interactions are. Okay? But the point is that for any theory that was in thermal equilibrium that couples this way, you're going to end up with some amount of thermal relic. Okay? And so the hope is that once we've understood that this phenomena can happen, maybe this can explain what dark matter is. The dark matter was just something that was coupled with thermal bath. It's not coupled anymore, and there's just some amount of it left over. Okay. So are there any questions about that before we move on to the Boltzmann equation for interacting systems? Okay. So ideally, we want to derive this whole picture in a more complete form. So the first thing that we're going to do is finish deriving the Boltzmann equation for interacting systems. Okay. Then what we're going to do is we're going to do a general solution for an example like we considered before, where we have some new particle chi, which can annihilate into standard model fermions. And we'll find out what the thermal history of this thing is. We'll show that it's a thermal relic and how much of it there is. And then we'll conclude by talking about something called the Wimp miracle, which is that when we do this general solution, we'll find an interesting connection between getting the right dark matter density and having particles associated with the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay. Start here. So if we follow the derivation that we had last time, what we had was some kind of kinetic term for our equation that was associated with changes in the number density, so related to, say, flows or the expansion of the universe. This was for some particle chi, say, n chi dot, it's 3 hn chi. If it's not interacting, then this is conserved, okay? Just because particle number is conserved, and so you can just use the expansion of the universe to solve this and find the number density. But in general, there's going to be some interaction term, which is called the collision term. And this basically accounts for the fact that we do have processes that can create and destroy chi. So chi isn't exactly conserved. It's going to be changing due to the interactions with the thermal bath. So what we say is that this, we define this collision term as C tilde of F. And C tilde of F, these Fs are all Fs of all particles that interact with chi, including chi itself. So basically the point is that the rate at which chi interacts is going to be determined by what other things it has to interact with. So for instance, if it's scattering elastically, the interaction rate is going to depend on how many of these standard model fermions are there. If it's annihilating with itself, it's going to depend on how many chi's. So this collision term is necessarily going to be somewhat complicated. So I'm not going to give the full derivation of it, but I'll just argue what its form has to be. Okay. So what do we usually do if we have, say, 1-2 scattering? The usual story, sorry, not 1-2 scattering, for 2-2 scattering, what you do is you draw some kind of Feynman diagram associated with the interaction. Okay, so let's say I have particle 1, particle 2, particle 3, and particle 4. Let's say I'm considering the scattering from left to right, so 1-2 going into 3-4. I can use the Feynman rules. And this tells me what the matrix element of the transition from the initial state to the final state is. So what I do first is I compute this matrix element of 1-2 goes to 3-4. So, I write down the couplings, write down the propagators, do the Dirac, or square the spins and do the Dirac traces. Okay. Now, let's assume that these are particles of arbitrary spin. I don't know whether they're scalars or fermions. The usual procedure is that we then sum over final degrees of freedom and average over initial. So what do I mean by degrees of freedom? What I mean by this are things like spin, color, etc. So usually, when you compute this m squared, you end up summing over the spins, and then this allows you to simplify the Dirac matrix algebra in terms of traces of gamma matrices and all of this kind of thing. Okay. And the usual justification for this is that if I'm colliding two particles 1 and 2, I don't necessarily know what spin or what color or what have you of the initial particles are. So the smart thing to do is to just average over it, to assume that I have some kind of random distribution. And then given those initial states, I want to sum over all of the possible final states. And that just follows from the usual Fermi's golden rule kind of arguments that you add over the total final phase space. Okay. So this gives us some kind of averaged matrix element. And then if we want an actual physical rate or a cross section, what we have to do is take the matrix element, which is a function of the momenta, and convert it into something that is, so this matrix element is a function of all four momenta. We want something that's only a function of the incoming momenta for the same reason. We want to sum over all of the possible final state configurations. So to get to the cross section, we integrate over final state momenta. And by integrate over, I mean that I integrate over this Lorentz invariant phase space, which is defined as the three momentum over some factor. And the reason why we do this is that if we do a Lorentz transformation on this integration variable, we find that it's Lorentz invariant. Okay, so this is the usual procedure. But what we want to do now is somewhat different, okay? Which is that when we're considering interactions in the early universe, we want to kind of include all of these processes. In particular, if I have some fermion that's annihilating, say, into photons, I can also have photons annihilating back into fermions. So now instead of just, say, 1 to 2 scattering into 3 to 4, I want both 1, 2, 3, 4, and 3, 4 goes to 1, 2. The other thing that I want to do is that in the early universe, I have some large ensemble of these initial states. So this isn't the LHC where I take a proton and another proton and collide them. This is a huge number of protons colliding with a huge number of photons colliding with a huge number of something else. So instead of doing just a basic average over the initial states, what we're going to do is a weighted average over the thermal distribution. Right? So this will tell us, okay, I can compute my cross-section for a given initial state momentum, and then I multiply that by the probability of having those initial momenta. That's just this phase-based distribution. So I'll integrate over all of those possibilities. So I'll integrate initial state over the thermal, well, actually, I won't say it's a thermal distribution, just over F1, F2, because we don't yet know that it's actually going to be thermal. Okay, so to make the calculation simpler, we're going to change, just for the purposes of this class, what this means. So what we're going to refer to by this is an average over both initial and final spins, colors, etc. So using this intuition, I can just write down then what I expect this collision term to be. Okay. The form of the collision term, if I imagine I have some process chi plus I plus j going to A plus B. So we're going to write this as general as possible, and then it's very easy to specialize to specific things. It has a sort of ugly form, but we'll go through it term by term. So first I'll define this quantity. This is it's basically the same as the Lorentz invariant phase space, but I'm going to add in this extra factor of the degrees of freedom. This just takes care of this this summing over the states in the bath associated with the thermal distribution. Okay. So what I get is d pi chi, d pi I, d pi j, d pi a, d pi b. So basically, we want to integrate over everything. 2 pi times, we're going to impose a delta function on the momenta. Now I'm going to multiply by the matrix element squared of chi plus to A plus B. Now because I'm going from chi to A plus B, I want to average over the initial state distribution. So I'm going to multiply it by F chi, F I, F j. Now just for completeness, in case you ever need to use this, we're also going to include the fact that technically, when we do Fermi's golden rule, we also sum over the final state distributions, and we have to worry about whether they're bosons or fermions. So for instance, fermions, if you want to go into a final state that's already occupied, it's blocked. For bosons, there's an enhancement for going into the same quantum state. So what you get are factors of 1 plus minus Fa times 1 plus or minus Fb, where this, once again, is boson fermion. So now what you see is that from this term, because there's this minus sign in front of it, processes that take chi into not chi tend to deplete the number density, because my number density n chi dot plus 3 h n chi is going to go like minus this rate. So now if I want to consider the positive contribution, I simply subtract the term going in the opposite direction. And then I just flip which form of the distributions I use. So this is going to be Fa times Fb times 1 plus or minus F chi. And then finally, I have to add one last thing, which is a symmetry factor. Okay. So this, if you go back to your notes in quantum field theory, shows up when you have identical particles. So S is the product of n factorial for all species I, where ni is the number of identical species in the initial or final state. What I mean by that is if I have chi chi bar going to something, this is 1. If I have chi chi, just chi chi going into something, then I have to divide by 2 factorial. And it doesn't matter whether the chi chi is in the initial state or the final state, I still have to divide by 2 factorial. Okay, so like I said, this mathematically, it's sort of an ugly expression, and there's a zillion integrals that we have to do. But conceptually, I'm just doing what I wrote on the board over there, where I'm considering interactions in both directions, and I'm averaging over the density functions associated with the phase space for each particle. Now, it's true that if you want to solve this differential equation, it's really not tractable in the current form. So what we're going to have to do is make some assumptions, and this will allow us to express it in a much simpler form. Okay. So what are the assumptions that we can make? So the first assumption that we're going to make is that the matrix element is the same in both directions. And what's the justification for this? Well, we know that there's a crossing symmetry associated with Feynman diagrams. So that if I write some chi I j interacting with A and B, I can just flip this diagram around. And I get basically the same thing. Now, this is almost true. If you're being really careful, these things are actually related by complex conjugation. But because we're taking the absolute value squared, you still get the same answer. There are ways that you can get differences between these two processes, but they require interference of various terms. It's a higher order effect. Right? And it's almost always subdominant. So basically, this is nearly always, basically always fine. So this is simple because it allows us to collect together these terms. Okay. The second thing that we're going to assume is that M of chi is much bigger than M of everything else. And the main motivation for this is that the whole process of thermal freeze-out relies on some Boltzmann suppression of that you get when this particle is heavy. And in the standard model, we have a bunch of light things. We have electrons, we have photons, we have up quarks, we have things that are almost massless. And so there's always going to be some stuff in the thermal bath that's lighter than chi. So we can take this assumption, and all it's going to do is maybe scale the number of particles in the thermal bath at a particular time. We're also going to assume that all other fields are in full equilibrium. So this means that, for instance, I can just say Fi is Fi equilibrium, Fa equals Fa equilibrium, and so on. What this means is that instead of solving this horrible integral differential equation that's both a function of the chi distribution and everything else, we're just kind of making it about chi and not about everything else. Everything else just responds as it would if it were in the thermal bath. The next thing we're going to do is ignore quantum statistics. By this, what I basically mean is that this equilibrium distribution can be replaced with just the regular Boltzmann distribution, and this is typically going to be small. In terms of the, at any given point, you're never close to saturating the phase-space distribution, so you don't have to worry about overlapping wavelengths and all this thing. So what this allows us to do is drop all of these 1 plus or minus factors. Just 1 plus or minus F equilibrium, just gone. The last thing we're going to assume is that chi is in kinetic equilibrium. This means that F chi is equal to some normalization factor times F equilibrium. And the reason for this, as we showed yesterday, is that these processes turn off later. So if we're interested in the dynamics of the first diagram going out of equilibrium, we can safely assume that it stays in kinetic equilibrium. Now, you'd always want to, once you solve this equation, go back and check your assumptions to make sure that at the time of freeze out, somehow it hasn't, we haven't messed things up and it is out of equilibrium. But once again, this is almost always true. So yeah, so in principle, this m squared is the total sum of everything. Yeah. So, but if it's a perturbative theory, then the higher order things are subdominant. Yeah. I should point out that this is sort of a weird equation, because this left-hand side here, it's classical in that this is just an evolution of some thermodynamic density. Whereas the right-hand side is quantum mechanical in that we're putting in matrix elements of quantum processes. So this whole equation, we say that it's semi-classical because it assumes that you have sort of fast, what's the word I'm looking for? What essentially consists of is that we have classical propagation and fast quantum scattering. So that basically things behave like classical distributions until all of a sudden they come to a point, and then you use quantum field theory to compute the interaction rate, and then they separate. This is, once again, almost always a good assumption. It only matters if there are weird quantum effects going on. So, you know, you're relying on cancellations of things and interference and that sort of thing. Then you might have to worry about that. Okay, so are there any questions about any of these assumptions, or you know, what any of them mean? Okay, so what we can now do is plug in those assumptions, and we'll see that they make the equation much simpler. So with these assumptions, what we get for C tilde of chi. Oh, I should also point out that just for simplicity, I'm now going to specialize to a two-body problem scattering. So say chi bar goes to FF bar, just so I don't have to have all the dots. But it's pretty easy to generalize this. So we have chi tilde, C tilde of chi is, so we're still going to integrate over the Lorentz invariant phase space. We still have our delta function. But now I can just sum over a single matrix element squared. And the only thing that changes is that when we're going in the forward direction, we're destroying chi, and so we're averaging over the chi distributions. And when we're going the opposite direction, we average over these F distributions, which are in thermal equilibrium. Okay. So, and then there's also this 1 over S. So normally there's a 1 over S, but because we don't have any identical particles, this is just 1. Okay. So let's see what we can do. So this basically uses assumption A, assumption C, and assumption D. So maybe I'll just write that in. This is A, C, D. So now we want to use the fact that we're assuming that chi is in a kinetic equilibrium. So because chi is in kinetic equilibrium, I can write its F just as beta F chi equilibrium. Now, if I were to integrate both sides of this equation, the integral of this F chi is just the number density. So when I integrate this equation, it gives me just N chi is equal to beta N chi equilibrium. So if I take the ratio of these equations, or rather what I can do is I show that F chi over F chi equilibrium is equal to beta is equal to N chi over N chi equilibrium. Once again, the fact that it's in kinetic equilibrium is just saying that the only deviation comes from the number density, and so obviously the ratio of these have to be the same as the ratio of these. So this allows me to make the substitution F chi is N chi over N chi equilibrium, F chi equilibrium. So this allows me to replace these horrible functions of both energy and time, which I don't understand, with something that's just a function of time, as well as a function that I know. Okay. So this allows me to greatly simplify the equation. So what does this give me? It gives me C tilde of chi is minus d pi, blah, 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 delta function, blah, 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 m squared. So this gives me n chi bar, over n chi equilibrium, n chi bar equilibrium, f chi bar equilibrium, minus ff, ff bar equilibrium. Now I'm going to go and use D again. I'm going to use D, so this was E here. I can now apply D to this equation. And I use the fact that this F chi equilibrium is just the Boltzmann equation, or Boltzmann factor. So what this means is that FF equilibrium, FF bar equilibrium, this is just E to the minus EF plus EF bar over T. And now I can use the fact that I have a delta function which conserves energy between the initial and final states. And we know that EF plus EF bar is just going to be the same as E chi plus E chi bar. And this, of course, is just F chi equilibrium, F chi bar equilibrium. So this allows me to bring out the equilibrium factors, and I end up with an even simpler expression. And here I'm just making the simplification that we're working in the limit where there's no asymmetry, so n chi and n chi bar are just the same. And what's great is that, remember that these n chi's, these are just equilibrium number densities. They're just functions of the time. They're not functions of energy. These integrals are integrals over momenta. So I can actually pull out all of these factors from outside of the integral. And so what I'm just left with doing is doing an integral over these various momentum distributions. All right. So from your QFT class, you probably wrote down a definition of the scattering cross section. Okay. This is 4 e chi bar v over d pi f bar 2 pi to the fourth. Times this matrix element squared. So you can already see that a bunch of the factors are going to be absorbed into this, right? So the d pi f bar, the delta function, and the matrix element. Okay, these just form a definition of a cross section. And this v is just defined this way. Chi and chi bar, chi and chi bar. I can also define something called thermal averaging, which is that if I take some function O, then I'm going to define this thermal average as 1 over n chi equilibrium, n chi bar equilibrium, d3p chi, d3p chi bar over 2 pi. Cubed. So this is any function that is a function of these momenta. I'm just defining a thermal average, which is I take the equilibrium number, phase space density, and I integrate over it. So if I take these definitions and plug them into the Boltzmann equation, what I find is a very simple form. I find that C tilde looks like this. Which means that my full equation is now, hopefully this doesn't look so bad. So we've taken this terrible integral differential equation, and by simply defining quantities in terms of particle physics, matrix elements integrated over various equilibrium phase space densities, we get this very simple form for the equation. So now what we can do is we can take this system of chi chi bar interacting with FF bar, and we can say, well, In our intuitive picture, we assumed that things were in equilibrium at early times. Is that true when I solve this equation? And so what we can do is we can define some quantity delta, which is the deviation from the equilibrium number density. And I can plug this into my equation. And what I get is something that looks like this. So this just comes from taking this equation and plugging it in. Now, hopefully, there's one equation that you already see looks familiar, which is this here. This is just the number density of chi times sigma times v. And this is just what we were calling earlier gamma. So this is a first principles derivation of this interaction rate. You know, we don't have to wave our hands about the various volumes and things. So this is proportional to gamma. And what we find is that these terms are all proportional to Hubble. That's obvious for these two because there's an explicit Hubble factor in front. But with this one, because this is a d by dt of n chi, n chi is varying very slowly just because of the expansion of the universe. So this characteristic derivative is also going to scale like Hubble. Yes. So it can, yeah. So you can definitely modify the equations to include that. Then what you have to do is separately keep track of n chi bar. So it turns out that it's easier to do in terms of these chemical potentials. Remember I said that basically n of a particle minus n bar of the particle goes like mu. So I can replace n chi bar with mu. And so then I just have to keep that in my equation. But for now, I'm just going to assume that all the asymmetries are zero. Okay, so we see right here these two parametric quantities that we were using in our kind of dimensional analysis. And so we immediately see that if gamma is much, much bigger than h, then my equation is just delta dot is minus gamma delta n. And so this is some exponential damping of delta n to zero. And of course, delta characterizes how different n chi is from n chi equilibrium. So we see that n chi approaches n chi equilibrium exponentially fast. So this is why we can make the assumption that if gamma is much bigger than h, then we're in thermal equilibrium. Conversely, if gamma is much smaller than h, then I just end up with the original Boltzmann equation with no collision term. I just get the usual okay. So this is exactly what we had predicted. So are there any questions about the derivation of the equation and this parametrics? Okay. So in the remaining time, we'll look at how we can actually solve the equation in more generality. So to do that, it's simpler to transform into a different set of coordinates. So first of all, we saw earlier that if instead of using number densities, we use this yield, it makes things simpler because it removes the effect of the expansion. So we're going to, instead of having n chi, we're going to replace it with y chi, which is just n chi over s. And then we're also going to define a dimensionless variable, which is m chi over the temperature. And we are going to replace t with x. The reason is that t is not a particularly useful variable in the sense that, okay, it's going in the right direction, that as the universe gets older or gets bigger, t gets larger. But t doesn't have any connection to any of the scales in the problem. Whereas we saw that the most important things were happening right when the temperature was sort of comparable to the mass, or going from relativistic to non-relativistic. So what we can do is we can use this variable to pick out the times. You know, when x is 1, this is exactly when chi is transitioning from being relativistic to non-relativistic. So one of the homework questions will be to take the Boltzmann equation to write it in terms of these new quantities. What you find is that it looks like this. So as expected, by transforming to the set of variables, we remove all of these extra terms that are proportional to Hubble, and we've just put everything into a single equation. Okay. Now, if we want to solve this equation in the fullest of generalities, we have to compute this sigma v. This is, in general, a very complicated function. Okay? And you'll do an example of it, but you don't want to do it too many times. So we don't really, this is going to be a complicated function of x. But what we're going to do is notice that this freeze out process, it happens after this particle has become non-relativistic. So because the dynamics are interesting in the non-relativistic phase, we're going to now assume that chi is non-relativistic. So this means, for instance, that I can write p chi as m chi 1 plus u squared over 2, 0, 0, m chi u, where u is some velocity. P chi bar is going to be the same, but it's going to be minus m chi u. This is just p equals mv. And because sigma v is a function of p chi and p chi bar, I can just make an expansion and say that sigma v is approximately equal to some constant plus some other constant plus u squared plus some other constant u to the 4, and so on. Because u is small in the non-relativistic era. And then I can use the fact that if I do a thermal average over u squared, just using the definition of thermal average, that this is just 3 over 2 times the dimensionless variable. So this means that I can, in quite generality, write sigma v as a plus 3b over 2x plus et cetera. So as x gets bigger, as you go to later times where it's more non-relativistic, the higher order terms are going to drop off. And what's going to matter is the leading term in this expansion of sigma v. Okay, so I can just plug sigma v as sigma n x to the minus n, where we're only going to keep the leading term. And this greatly simplifies things. Okay. So this is an x to the minus n. The entropy S goes like t cubed. And t goes like 1 over x. So entropy is going to go like x to the minus 3. So I can group together the x's from here, here, and here. And this gives me some overall constant, some x dependence, and the part that depends on the distributions. So this looks like something we can actually solve. It's still not something that we can just exactly integrate, but we can again use various approximations. We see that what really matters is this rate gamma compared to h. So first I should tell you what this lambda is, actually. I didn't write it on the board. If you just collect the terms, lambda is s sigma v over h evaluated at x equals 1. And if you work it out, this is just gamma over h at x equals 1. So when this is in equilibrium and gamma is much bigger than h, then lambda is a big number. And when gamma over h is small, then lambda is a small number. So we can sort of solve the equation in two regions and try and match the solutions. So what do we get here? Well, we know that when things are in equilibrium, we just showed that this quantity delta becomes a small number. So this seems like a reasonable quantity. So I can define an analogous one for chi, for the yields. And in this regime, delta and delta prime are going to be small. The deviation from equilibrium is much smaller than the equilibrium distribution. Okay, so I can take my equation and rewrite it this way. And now I can just cross out the various subdominant terms, okay? So this term I can cross out, this term I can cross out, this term I should not cross out because there's a big number that's a prefactor. Okay. But this term I can also cross out. Is that right? No. This term I want to keep. Yeah. That's right, because it's y equilibrium. It's big. Okay. So now I can just simply, it's gone from a differential equation to an algebraic equation, and so I can just solve. So delta in this region is going to be proportional to x to the n plus 2 over lambda. And because lambda is a big number, this is small, and everything is self-consistent. So good. It's very simple. So in this region, we have gamma much smaller than h. This means that lambda is small. Actually, I'm not going to say that because... Sorry, I just realized that in this set of notes, I define lambda as evaluated at a particular x. So this is not something that changes with x. But lambda is a big number, okay? But we now have gamma is less than h, so this is an x much bigger than 1. Okay, so in this region, we know that things are going out of equilibrium, so expect the deviation from equilibrium to be big. So we're just going to take these conditions. So before we said the deviation was small. Now we can say the deviation is big. So this delta is basically going to be the size of the equilibrium distribution. And this is going to be much, much bigger than y chi equilibrium. Right, so delta is y chi minus y chi equilibrium. This is exponentially damping. This is something that's basically going to be fixed. So now we can plug it into our equation. Using this set of assumptions, we get this equation. And this basically comes from canceling out the different terms. So before we threw out this term and this term, now we're going to throw out this term and this term. So this is an actual differential equation that we have to solve. But we can just integrate it. And if we assume that delta y at some x freeze out is 0, and then we integrate from x freeze out to infinity, what we basically find is that delta y of infinity, which is just y chi of infinity, n plus 1 over lambda, x frees out to the n plus 1. And this just comes from solving the separable differential equation. So now we have these two equations, and what we want to do is we want to match them somehow. So the matching condition is sort of implied from the different limits that we took, which was that the rate is much smaller than Hubble in this sector, and gamma is much bigger than Hubble in this sector. And so you can match them when essentially defining this gamma at h, x frees out as h, x frees out. Okay. So this implicitly defines x freeze out, and it allows me to go from this small deviation solution into the large deviation solution. So now this is a generally a tricky equation to solve because this gamma goes like n sigma v. So the left-hand side is going to go something like x naught to the 3 halves e to the minus x, blah, blah, blah. This goes like x to the minus 2. So this is some transcendental equation, which I can't solve exactly, but I can solve it, for instance, iteratively. And so the last thing I'll write down for today is what the solution of x frees out is. X frees out looks like, keeping all of the constants now, so I'm showing both the leading solution and the first correction if you're doing an iterative solution. But as you can see, if I'm trying to solve this equation, it's going to look like some kind of log dependence on the parameters. Okay? So log dependence is on some numerical prefactors, some numbers of degrees of freedom, times m chi, m Planck, sigma m. So there are a few comments to make about this. Because chi frees out depends logarithmically on m Planck, this immediately tells me that x frees out is going to be bigger than 1. So this justifies our use of this expansion where we only kept the highest order term in x. The second thing is that this x frees out, because it depends only logarithmically on all of the parameters, it's always going to fall within some small range. So typically, x frees out is between 20 and 30 for all ranges of cross sections and masses if this thing is sort of in the usual range of particles that we think about. Right? And again, the reason is just that the dependence is logarithmic. So what this allows us to do is make a fairly robust estimate of what this delta y is, because the dependence on this x frees out is not much when you change the models. And so this allows us, which we'll do tomorrow, to make a very definitive prediction for how much of this particle there is based on the parameters of the theory. And this allows us to connect the scattering cross-section to the dark matter abundance. Okay. So are there any questions about the solving of this differential equation? Yes. Ah, good. Yeah, so that was used implicitly because if the mass of the particle is smaller than all of the other ones, then the annihilation rate doesn't just depend on a Boltzmann suppression of m chi, but it also depends on mf. right? So if I look at this diagram, if this is lighter than this, then when this is non-relativistic, these final states are very non-relativistic. And so we've been assuming that the rate goes like e to the minus m chi over t, but then it would also have a factor of e to the minus m final state over t. So the fact that you don't have that suppression is how that assumption works into it. Okay, any other questions?
What's the number inside the square root?
90 over 8 pi cubed. This just comes from various factors in the entropy and in the definition of Hubble. Yeah. So for instance, it's the definition of Hubble that gives you the square root of g star. But again, these constants don't really matter so much just because it's a log dependence on everything. So the key thing is that it's the x freeze out is always going to be in the same range. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow morning then.